Hello and welcome to the OMPIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about geographic inequality, urban development, and the rise of economic hubs. This is Pierre Ortlieb from London, and today we're talking to Eddie Ijash-Vasquez, a senior director at the World Bank. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Pierre.
So, Eddie, I just wanted to start by giving you a short prompt. I came across an article by someone you know, I think, called Brina Lipper, who is the chief resilience advisor at the 100 Resilient Cities Network. And she had this article, I think, in the aftermath of the 2017 meeting. One of the lines I thought was interesting, and it's quite broad, so it's probably a good point to start. Let me just read this to you. It says, planning must always allow for a certain degree of uncertainty. However, two major trends make past precedents especially hard to rely on as we design for the future. Climate change and technological innovation continue to disrupt city systems in unpredictable ways. So I think the gist of this message is that history can't really serve as much of a guide to urban development in the 21st century. Is that an assessment you would agree with? And what makes planning so difficult these days? Why is this era unprecedented?
Yes, I would agree very much with that statement. And let me try to unpack the questions in two parts. First, on climate change. With climate change, the global models can tell us with pretty good precision, given the content of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, what is going to happen in terms of temperature, a little bit of more prediction on melting of the ice caps, some prediction on extreme events like hurricanes or typhoons. But when you start going to the local level, the models are not precise enough, and there are different models from the Japanese Space Agency to NASA to the European Space Agency, and they, when you downscale them, give you a little bit of variation at the city level. What does that mean? Is that we don't necessarily know with enough precision how strong the floods and the droughts in a given city, in a given location are going to be. What does that mean? Is that if a city, for example, is going to be constructing a levee or building protection against future floods, there's not enough precision as we had in the past. So in the past, when I was an engineer some decades ago, then we knew pretty much what was going to be the expectation on the floods every 50 years, every 100 years, more or less, and you would plan in what was called an optimal design. You would have so much money, that's how much protection you can get. Now we are entering into areas of deeper uncertainty, and therefore the planning cannot be optimal, cannot be so precise, but is beginning to become a planning methodology that is called robust. A planning methodology that allows cities to say, look, we don't know. The models tell us that this is the range of possibilities. And what is the optimal approach for us to be able to have better options to adapt today and in the future? So, for example, some cities are saying, look, we cannot protect ourselves with just building huge levees and concrete. We may need a combination of green solutions and concrete infrastructure solution. So you buy space for park areas, that if the floods become even more serious in the future, then you can use them as pond retention to prevent the floods. But if the floods are not as serious as the models expect, then you may be able to develop those spaces. So buying those options today mean that you cannot predict with perfection the future, but you can have a range of options to be able to adapt better to the most reasonable circumstances that the climate change models tell us. So that's an additional complication for urban planners, but I think that the consequence is that the urban planners now need to look at nature and spaces and breathing areas far more seriously than in the past, which I think is good because then the association between cities and nature can become stronger. Resilience and adaptation needs nature in the end. You cannot buy yourself out of risk just by building concrete infinitely. Now, the second topic on technology is that we see a tremendous acceleration of technology in so many ways that are going to be affecting city development and interaction between city government officials and citizens in completely different ways. So you think about social media and how the municipalities are able to use it for a completely different way of dialogue and interaction and participation with the citizens. What we begin to see in terms of sensors and data to understand how the city lives and operates, it's going to give tools to planners that are going to be inimaginable today, just a few years down the road. And actually how to use all of that data for citizens to be able to be co-creators of solutions with the cities It's just something that is not even possible today. So we are, I think, at the cusp of a lot of technological revolutions that require cities and their institutions to be far more adaptable than in the past, because the pace of change is going to accelerate. And therefore, it's not only to know what is the latest technology, but also to understand that the technology of today is going to be obsolete a lot faster than years before. So I think that these are additional uncertainties that cities are going to be facing, but also they bring tremendous opportunities for sustainable urban development.
That's right. So let me just try to begin unpacking your own unpacking of my initial question. The overarching theme in your response on climate change especially seems to me, and this is obviously something that you are very familiar with, is this idea of resilience, right? Being resilient to challenges such as climate change. You had a blog post, I think, a while ago about how Eastern and Central European cities are aging in unprecedented ways and how they can build resilience to that. For me, this idea of resilience has certain connotations, right? It's about adaptation. It's about sort of being flexible. Whereas I think critics might argue that as opposed to resilience, perhaps it would be better to put more effort into prevention, right? So preventing young migrants from leaving these now prosperous Eastern European cities, for example, rather than simply adapting to this sort of perceived inevitability. Is that something that you've encountered before, this kind of tension between resilience and prevention? And how does that apply to your work as a policy planner?
So look, actually prevention is part of resilience in the sense that we see resilience is as the ability of individual households, communities, and cities to be prepared and to respond well to shocks of different nature and to bounce back faster and stronger. Shocks being either natural disasters or shocks due to economic shocks or to wave of migrants that step on your door or conflicts, crime and violence, many different dimensions that cities and individuals need to deal with. Now, part of being resilient is also not to be a passive recipient of this risk, but to enhance your preparedness, meaning how do you understand the sources of those risks and how do you tackle those risks into this process? So, for example, yes, you may be having climate change and maybe the impacts may be outside your control at the local level, but the way in which the city grows, the way in which land is regulated, the way in which construction is getting stronger to make sure that they can withstand stronger winds and hurricanes, that's part of reducing the risk to that process. But it's also hard to understand what is it that, for example, trash that is not collected and gets into the drainage ditches or into the canals or rivers of the city exacerbates those risks. And therefore, you tackle the solid waste collection, therefore you reduce the risk. That's an important part of resilience, as you were saying. So preparedness and reducing the risk factors. Second, understanding what are your sources of risks. And third, being prepared for when those risks materialize to bounce back. And that is not only on the infrastructure side that we tend to think is the most important part, but it's also on the finance. A challenge that many cities have is that when a flood or an earthquake happens, there's not enough provision to tap into quick finance to be able to respond fast to that disaster. And therefore, municipalities and national governments are scrambling to find those resources to do things as basic as cleaning debris. So infrastructure, second finance, and third, social resilience. It's not enough to just having good early warning systems that tell you a hurricane is coming or to have good housing infrastructure that allows you to resist the hurricane. You have your financial pot of money to be able to respond after a disaster. The ability of households and individuals and communities to have that social fabric to support each other becomes a really critical part. So remember, some of the heat waves in Europe, the people that get the most affected and the people that die from those heat waves tend to be older persons without a social network and without the support from neighbors and the community to check on them to make sure that they don't suffer tremendously from these heat waves. So it's not only the air conditioning solution, it's not only the community centers with air conditioning, it's also the ability of having social resilience for communities to withstand these shocks.
Yeah, that's right. I want to get to financing in a second, but I just want to touch on a slightly different theme that is related to everything that you've just mentioned. And it's something that you wrote about recently is this idea of displaced persons, right? And that's linked to climate change in a sense that climate change is one of the main risk factors to many cities. and is a development that is likely to produce vast swaths of migrants, of displaced people. So that's very much at the intersection, I think, of urban planning and climate change, because a lot of these sort of newly displaced people are likely to migrate to new cities. And so my question in this respect is, are cities prepared to deal with a sort of much larger influx of climate change related migrants, especially in sort of developing countries and emerging markets? How are they dealing with displaced people both at present, and how are they building the capacity to deal with greater waves in the future?
It's interesting to see that when you see in the news the displaced people and refugees, either because of natural disasters or because of man-made conflicts, the natural reaction for most people is that they all go into refugee camps. But the reality is that a large majority of them in regions like in the Middle East and North Africa actually go to cities. And therefore, it becomes a far more complex response, because when you have refugees in camps, or after an earthquake, you have people in camps, it's easier to understand who they are, to provide for the services to help them bounce back from those disasters. When they get dispersed into the city, then the mayors begin to realize that they have a tremendous need for expansion of public services, for jobs, for mechanisms to enhance social cohesion. I personally have met with mayors from Jordan and Lebanon that are doing a heroic job, for example, with the massive influx of Syrian refugees. We have seen mayors, for example, in the city of Medellin in Colombia, who basically saw their population double and triple over the matter of a few years because of the internal conflict, and how these mayors, instead of basically turning their back to these refugees, embrace the situation and mobilize the community, the city, the private sector to say, look, these are brothers and sisters. How do we integrate into our social fabric? How do we tackle them as a problem? It's not easy, because then the city ends up in an accelerated challenge of provision of services, of provision of jobs and opportunities, of provision of education and health to refugees and migrants. So it's never easy to handle those situations. But first step, as I always say, you need to be ready for the disasters of the migration of today to be able to be ready for the disasters of tomorrow that are due to climate change or for any shocks due to refugees and migrants that may appear at your door. So it requires good planning, strong resilience, perspective on everything that you do as a city mayor, but also for communities and civil society to also think that these shocks may be just around the corner and have to get ready for them.
You sort of touched on one primary method of finance that's often used for things like infrastructure and generally urban development projects. So this idea of public-private partnerships is one of them, and you mentioned Medellin, where educational institutions have in recent years been funded by public-private partnerships, although that has been perhaps a slightly controversial development, I think, in Colombia. One aspect that I wanted to speak about is land value capture. And this is, I think, a growing theme in financing urban development projects. This idea of the state capturing rents that are produced by rising property values, things like that. So that's been the case in China, for instance, in Shenzhen, where this kind of model has been very popular, as well as in Rwanda, where perhaps there isn't much of an international financial infrastructure. So the state and local investors are better able to use this kind of mechanism. Can you tell us a little bit about what land value capture is and how you feel it can be integrated better into urban development financing in coming years?
Absolutely. Let me take a minute before I get into land value capture to put it into context. One of the challenges every municipality has in developed countries and in developing countries is finance to expand infrastructure and to provide the services and to make cities more livable. And one of the challenges that is very common in developing countries is that cities don't necessarily know the timing and the amounts of transfers from the national government to the city. The city sometimes don't have enough regulatory frameworks or the ability to collect taxes and fees at the local level. Sometimes there's not enough even information for these cities to be able to collect property taxes or land taxes that are so common in cities around the world. And in many places, there is not a clear social contract between cities and their citizens, so that the citizens trust that if they pay taxes and fees, they are going to be used efficiently and transparently for the services that the city needs to provide. So all these elements are important constraints for cities, and there's no one single solution that is going to fix the tremendous financial need of urban areas around the world. one of the tools, and we're not saying again that it's the only tool, but one important tool that has been shown to be effective in many countries around the world is what you call land value capture. When the city provides the infrastructure to certain services, let's say a metro or parks or important expansion of water and sanitation services, the value of the land that now is served with that infrastructure generally goes up. And that's part of an important boost to economic growth and development of the city. Now, what land value capture allows is that as the value of that land increases and real estate is developed, then a portion of that land value can be, in a way, captured or retained by the municipalities to be able to finance the next wave of infrastructure. Now, in places where you have a well-established local tax base, then as the property values increase and there's good valuation system, then the municipality can get those revenues from the regular tax process, and they can use financial instruments to monetize the future taxes to be able to finance infrastructure. When there is less clear, or when you want to make sure that the persons or the private sector companies that are gaining the most value out of that can come closer partners in the raising of those funds, then land value capture can be a potential instrument. Now, there are many modalities, and it goes, for example, for the one of the earlier cases was the development of the intercity rail system in Japan that was developed just by saying to the railway companies, okay, you can develop that, and in exchange, you get the development rights for the stations and the real estate market around them. And actually, this is how those rail systems in Japan got financed. And the railway companies are, in a way, also real estate companies into this process. Again, mentioning Colombia, the city of Medellin also has what they call the valorization tax, a very structured process that when they develop infrastructure, the land value estimations is spread and is done in a transparent manner and in a very participatory manner for approval by the communities before the project gets done. We are right now experimenting in the World Bank with some cities around the world combining resilience and land value capture. So imagine that a portion of the city is regularly flooded. The municipality may not have adequate resources to build flood protection, but if they were to build that flood protection, the value of that land would increase because it's not flooded anymore. So how do you close the loop and allow the real estate development and the public-private partnership to raise funds where the flood protection is done, where the entire value of those benefits is not just captured by certain companies, but it is actually done in a way that is balanced, sustainable urban development. And I think that there are win-win-win opportunities in some of these areas moving forward. I'll conclude again by saying that this is not just the only solution, but it is part of the package of financial solutions that a city needs to be looking to be able to grow sustainably.
I like that point a lot about the synergies between resilience and value capture. Can you give us any hints about where this has taken place and what the successes have been so far, or is it still sort of fairly under wraps?
Actually, let's see. So, for example, we had a project in Buenos Aires that used to get flooded, and we did an infrastructure for flood protection. It was fascinating to see that once that project got completed, a third of the city stopped being flooded, and then the property values began to go up really fast. That's when we began to realize the tremendous power of these mechanisms. And we are beginning to talk with cities from Panama City to Addis Abeba to Canto in Vietnam to start figuring out whether these mechanisms can be implemented. It's very much at the frontier of experimentation and development in this topic. And we hope that within a couple of years, we should be able to see interesting results into this process, where, again, we combine issues of financial sustainability, issues of sustainable urban development, so that the new areas are not just commercial shopping centers, but real mixed development, and also solutions that bring green protection, green resilience as part of the package. So this is where the public function and the public urban planning becomes really important, and it's not just the financial and the economic growth, it's that balance of making the city more livable and more resilient.
That's fascinating. Yeah, thank you. Just a final point. So let me explain. So the reason why I mentioned land value capture specifically is because I came across this book fairly recently by Dag Detter and Stefan Felster, where they talk about urban wealth funds, right? And at OMFIF, we work with public investors a lot. So obviously this idea that cities could capture public wealth in that sense, it was quite appealing to me. And obviously one of the main assets that they talk about, part of these sort of urban wealth funds, is real estate, right? So this idea that through appreciation in real estate value that cities would be able to build their social, human, and economic wealth. That was quite fascinating. Have you come across this idea of urban wealth funds, so to speak, in parallel to the model of sovereign wealth funds?
So what is really important and what we find as a common deficiency in many cities around the world is that the mayors don't necessarily know what public assets do they have or what public assets the government in its different layers, national, provincial, municipal level, have in a given city. So if you don't know what are the public assets, your ability to maximize and optimize the wealth and the ability of the city to maximize that wealth for the good of the population is actually very limited. So the urban wealth funds, as many other ideas of that kind, basically go to the basic of how can a city know what are the true public assets in terms of land, unused land, public buildings, etc. How do you have that information in a way that you optimize its use? How do you explore public-private partnerships? How do you explore areas that really need to be very public to protect for public functions? How do you actually know whether the railway company has land assets that are no longer used, but for legal and regulatory constraints cannot be used, and therefore the city is sprawling while they have marvelous land assets unused in the downtown of the city? So part of our recommendation and where we work with many cities is really this land and property assets as a critical part of the process. Second, land registries and land markets that allow for well-functioning markets in city. We see, for example, many cities in Africa where the private sector says, look, the land in capital cities in Africa is way too expensive. But the reality is that it's not the land. It is the land with clear and believable titles that can be enforced in a court of law. That's the one that is really difficult to find, and therefore it is very expensive. So systems where the cities have good land registries and land asset management processes is fundamental. The mechanisms to be able to capture that value, to enhance the wealth, to use it for public good, there are of many different types. But at the core is information, transparency, practical governance on land and public assets.
Yeah, that's right. And do you think this is an area where technology in particular can play an important role? The reason I ask is because it seems like digitalizing things like land registries, which I think you mentioned had taken place in the Punjab fairly recently, that seems like an area where technology can really thrive and assist in providing better data for mayors to know what public assets they have, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only for mayors, but also for governors of provinces. So the land is one of those assets that is fundamental, not only for governments, but if you think of it, the land and your house is the most important asset that most families have anywhere in the world. And especially poor families in developing countries is pretty much where they put a lot of their savings and where that stability allows them to escape poverty. If they don't have clear land titles and secure rights, then they don't invest in that process. The quality of their housing is actually quite bad. It impacts their health, it impacts their savings, opportunities, etc. So it's not only for governments, but also for individuals and households that this idea of clear land titles and rights is so important. And as you said, technology is, and especially technology in the last 5 to 10 years, has radically changed the way in which these land registries can work. It has driven down the cost of doing that process by a factor of 10 or 100, depending on the country, with a tremendous speed. So we see a real revolution on technology and geospatial information for these land and property titles and rights that I think is going to be one of the most important transformations for cities and provinces in the next decade.
Great. Thank you very much. So it sounds like this is an era of optimistic uncertainty, if I might put it that way. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation. This was a good conversation. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a pleasure as well. Thank you very much.